Do have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order. And John, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if everyone has a copy of the spreadsheet, the first page is essentially fund totals for spending in the bill and healthcare and TANF fund balances. I will skip to the second page of the spreadsheet, just below the very dark black line, and talk about the initiatives that were included in the bill before you. The first provision, the governor's proposal on background studies fee alignment, the House chose to accept the governor's proposal there, as well as background studies compliance with federal requirements.
I could just interrupt again. Members, if you have a clarifying question, that's fine, but I don't think we need to get into updates today. But if you need to some clarified, go ahead and ask.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, on line 88 of the spreadsheet, the governor had a proposal for MFIP federal compliance, and this was something to try to meet work requirements within TANF, and the House chose to go about that in a different manner, so that proposal was not included in the bill. The House did fund the MFIP for legal non-citizens continuation, removing the sunset for legal non-citizens participation in the MFIP program. We did include the governor's proposal on MFIP time limit and program violations for people who do not voluntarily comply with the requirements of the program. Moving to page 3, the House has included provisions to... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. There was another one at the very last line on page 2. The House chose to include provisions that would repeal the MFIP SSI penalty, and on page 3, repeal the MFIP housing penalty. Those penalties were $125 and $50, respectively. On line 131, the House includes a provision to eliminate the MFIP 20-hour work requirement for post-secondary education, as well as includes that refugees would go directly to the MFIP program rather than be sent to the diversionary work program. Mr. Chair, on line 143, the bill also adds two participant groups to the MFIP hard-to-employ category. And line 149 eliminates MFIP work hour requirement for employed hardship extension. Mr. Chair, on line 156, the bill also includes a provision to increase the exit level from the MFIP program from 115% of poverty, which is in current law, and bring that level up to 140% of poverty. Mr. Chair, on line 163, the bill includes a provision for the Workforce U program. That was House File 2111. It also includes a pediatrics medical home project, which I believe was an amendment introduced on a prior bill that was heard in this committee. Mr. Chair, moving to page 4. There's also a TANF provision which would include $750,000 a year for the Office of Higher Ed Work Study Program. Mr. Chair, in line 182, the Child Care Assistance Program was an initiative by the governor that is included in the, I believe, the Early Childhood Committee, so that is why zeros appear on both sides of the spreadsheet for that provision. Mr. Chair, on line 193, the bill includes $8 million for a one-time aid to counties for child support enforcement. And the bill also includes a proposal similar to the governor's on adoption assistance and relative custody assistance, but includes a change in an increase from that program, similar to the Senate, which reduces the increase from 5% to 3.95%. Mr. Chair, on line 209, House File 638, Adoption Assistance Program Eligibility Modified was included. It was a very small cost. On line 215, House File 1290, was to set up a child safety network that would include programs that would set a safety network up among counties. We've included $1 million a year to look into and do some preliminary costs for that program. Mr. Chair, on line 221, we include $1.1 million per year added to the base of the crisis nursery funding. Moving to page 5, on line 227, we included the governor's proposal of $40 million in one-time county case management funding for to help counties deal with the loss of federal funds. Mr. Chair, on line 233, we included $2 million in fiscal year 2008 for House File 1524, which was a grant to the Red Lake Band to expand their child welfare project. We also included on line 239 several bills that were group residential housing increases, House File 185 in Crow Wing, 1068 in St. Louis. House Files 913 and 120 were Hennepin and Ramsey County group housing, group residential housing programs, and one in Stern and St. Louis County, that was House File 341. Mr. Chair, on line 249, we included $140,000 a year in TANF funding for a Hennepin County New Chance program. And on line 255, $450,000 a year for the Ramsey County Mother's First program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
Just a short question. Back to line 245. That includes the teen challenge. Is that the request? Those two funded, was that funded as a full request for both programs? You know that?
No.
Mr. Walls might know.
Representative Edwards, that's the 245 is the... Scottwell bill that relates to chronic alcoholics.
Well, then which one is Teen Challenge? Is that which line is that?
Challenge is 241.
Okay.
And I'm not sure. Yeah, 1068 is the one in St. Louis County.
Yeah, my question was that the request for the dollar amount. Okay. Thank you very much. That's all I need to know.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I believe for all those bills, we included the cost to fully fund the bill from each of the fiscal notes.
All right. Thank you very much. That helps.
Mr. Chair, on line 262, the long-term homelessness implementation, again, was the governor's initiative that was moved to another committee. That is Karen Clark's housing health and housing committee, or I'm sorry, the correct name escapes me. On line 269, the governor's proposal to comply with federal requirements for immigration status validation and at recertification is included. Mr. Chair, the bill does not include the governor's proposal for a health care enrollment transfer, which would be increase the amount transferred from the health care access fund to the general fund. Mr. Chair, moving down to page 6, on line 287, we have a technical piece here. This is allowing the Department of Human Services some flexibility with their expenditure based on a delay in implementing Health Match, and this provision allows them to deal with a delay of up to 6 months. 6 months if that the system is delayed due to the many healthcare changes that are included in this bill that may cause a delay in implementing the Health Match system. Mr. Chair, on line 295, included in the bill was the governor's proposal on DSH money, the disproportionate share hospital dollars that we can claim from the federal government. Mr. Chair, on line 305, the Healthy Connections proposal, the bill does not include the governor's proposal on Minnesota Care 2. It does include the Section 125 plans and $6 million under the Department of Health to set up the exchange, which is shown later in the bill. On line 321, the governor's proposal for client medical access mileage adjustment is included, as are the two QCARE pay-for-performance initiatives at the bottom of page 6 and the top of page 7. We also included the governor's proposal on extending the critical access dental program. And on line 358, we have House File 276 was a Minnesota Care self-employed farmers bill that I believe increases the amount of assets that self-employed farmers may have and still qualify for Minnesota Care. On line 365, there is a provision for MA reimbursement for community health worker services. On line 372, a medical asset limit revision, which allows higher asset limits for people with disabilities, I believe, to go and participate in the or receive MA benefits. In line 378, there was a modification to disabled parental contribution, which was House File 785. And on line 384, a provision that was also included in the Senate bill to change alternative payment methods for FQHCs and RHCs. Mr. Chair, at the top of line, or the top of page 8, House File 570, it was eliminating the ratable reductions for Bethesda Hospital. Line 399, House File 705, an increase in the MRRC waiver family support programs. Mr. Chair, on line 405, another provision that is similar to the Senate for self-directed support options. This was included in House File 911. On line 412, a provision that appears in House File 1873, MA coverage for Medicare part copays for dual eligibles. And on line 418, we have $500,000 a year for an increase to Gillette Hospital. I'm sorry, there's a misspelling there, Mr. Chair. Gillette Outpatient Hospital Rate Increases. Mr. Chair, on line 424, are all the dollars involved with implementing House File 1. The provisions in the bill include an October 1st implementation date in 2009 at a 225% of poverty level, and in January of 2011, increasing that to 300%, which was the full poverty level in the original engrossment of House File 1. Mr. Chair, on the top of page 9, there is money in for House File 2181, the Youth Special Kids Program. This was the care coordination piece. On line 453, House File 1399 is $1,050,000 for the Northeast Minnesota Healthcare Demonstration Project. On line 459 is a provision similar to the Senate bill, Patient Incentive Program, health costs, and this would, I believe, provide incentives to patients with chronic diseases to undertake certain health maintenance practices. On line 468 was House File 286, a $75,000 a year to increase fetal alcohol syndrome funding. On line 474, a pilot project at $1 million a year for 08 and 09, a community collaborative pilot project to cover the uninsured. On line 480, there is a health care payment reform pilot project at $1 million a year for 08 and 09. Mr. Chair, on line 486, there is acceptance of the governor's proposal for administrative funding for citizenship documentation. Again, I believe this is part of meeting new federal requirements. On line 494, there's a difference from the governor. The spreadsheet includes money for long-term care payment rate adjustments of 3% in fiscal 08 and 3% in fiscal 09. Mr. Chair, moving to page 10, on line 513, the governor's proposal for elderly waiver assisted living coverage is funded. The committee did not include the governor's proposal on home and community-based service provider standards. Under the governor's mental health initiative, costs are included for what the governor suggested, his suggested changes in Minnesota Care. And, Mr. Chair, on the bottom of page 11, the House includes differing provisions from the governor's proposal for some of the mental health initiatives that were proposed in House File 196, and those provisions are included there.
Mr. Wall, what's the total amount in the governor's budget for the mental health initiatives, and what's the total amount?
Mr. Chair, the amounts are similar for the first biennium. The proposals that were included from House File 96 have lower tails than the governor. So in fiscal years 2010 and 11, the governor's tail spending is $74 million, and the House spending would be $66 million. Mr. Chair, moving to the top of page 12, the bill includes the governor's proposal for increased funding to the deafblind program. The bill does not include the governor's proposal to shift funding of the HIV/AIDS insurance program from general fund to healthcare access fund. That proposal was mainly just a shift in the funding that pays for the program. There was no increase or decrease in that proposal. Two senior nutrition program bills were included, House File 444 and 971. The amounts are shown there, $250,000 a year for 444 and $575,000 for the items in House File 971. The House File 1170 Living at Home Block Nurse Program was included but does not include the automatic inflationary increase that they had requested. The House File 320, the para-nursing facilities cost reimbursement piece is included, as well as the Big Stone County Nursing Home Facility Rate Adjustment. That was a bill, as you recall, had a cost of $1,000 a year.
John, on line 648, you need to change the nursing.
Oh, it's incorrect, Mr.
Chair? Yeah, it's not spelled right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I only guarantee the numbers and not my spending. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 660, there were several small bills for nursing home rate changes that were included in the bill, and I believe the copy of the spreadsheets that you have had something labeled incorrectly. On line 662, that is the Martin Luther home. And on line 664, that one is the Mason's home. And those are both in Hennepin County. We also included 1804 for Kennebec County, 2254 for Waseca, 586 for Rice, 1620 for Chisago, and 1812 was a home in Robbinsdale. Mr. Chair, moving to the top of the next page. It looks like there's one cut off at the bottom. Another provision that's in the Senate bill as well, increased medical non-emergency transportation wheelchair rates. That was $100,000 a year. On line 678, $80,000 a year for the hearing loss mentor program. On 684, the county repayment forgiveness for disabilities overspending, we included the Fillmore County provision only. Mr. Chair, on line 690, there were two provisions for Native American Juvenile Treatment Center programs. $50,000 for pre-design for the White Earth Band. That's House File 1584. And I don't have the bill number, but there was, I believe, a Representative Moe bill for Leech Lake, and that is $75,000 per year. Mr. Chair, also an amendment that went on to the governor's bill in committee on line 696 for disability linkage lines. That is included. On line 702, $300,000 for grants for assistive technology. On line 708 is House File 2005, the Kinship Navigator Program. On line 714 and 720, we're including funding from the lottery revenues for two compulsive gambling programs. Moving down to page 14, we have included the governor's suggestions for the nursing home report card expansion and the reduction in spending for Minnesota Security Hospital census adjustment. This was keeping a housing pod from opening because the their estimates presume that fewer people will be included at the security hospital than they had estimated at the end of last session. Mr. Chair, the bill does not include any TANF refinancing. There is the acceptance of a governor's provision suggesting the cancellation of a $250,000 prior TANF appropriation that was done, I believe, 2 years ago and remains unspent, and that will cancel if not spent by a certain date, I believe the end of fiscal year 2008. Mr. Chair, we have included the same amount of money for compensation adjustments for the department. Mr. Chair, moving down to page 15, again, there are several things that you may see here for the Department of Health with zeros on both sides. These are provisions that appear in the Housing and Health Committee's jurisdiction, and so those issues have been moved there. We start down on line 816. We have accepted, I believe, all of the governor's initiatives for the Department of Health with one notable change, and that was the establishing the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. We have funded at $6 million instead of $12 million, and that is a one-time cost. Oh, and Mr. Chair, on line 816, the e-health grants, we've adopted similar language the way the Senate approaches that, and that moves, since the money is available rather than allowing the spending over 3 years, just moves all of the money or $27 million into the first 2 years or the 08-09 biennium and establishes a revolving loan fund. Mr. Chair, the only two...
Money on 816, is that healthcare access fund money?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, which line? 816?
Well, the second
Mr. Chair, it is the proposal is healthcare access fund currently in the governor's proposal, the proposal in front of you, and I believe the Senate proposal as well. Mr. Chair, the only two additions by the committee would be the two on the last page, line 869, $70,000 a year for a hearing aid loan bank, which was House File 1071, and on line 875, $300,000 in 08 for a community initiative to cover uninsured and underinsured. And, Mr. Chair, that completes all of the fiscal provisions included in the bill before you.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Once we've had a copy of the bill, which we're not going to move today, I noticed that when I helped, this will be a lot of disappointment to some people, but on page 116...
Excuse me, on page 116, line point 3... it says the COLA is going to be 5%, and the COLA is, as most of us know, is going to be 3%, unfortunately. Representative Fritz, you had a comment on that?
Well, I think that might have been a divine inspiration.
So, with that, we'll start with testimony on the bill, which is related primarily to, I think, the spreadsheet, because people haven't really seen most of the language. And first we have Department of Human Services.
And Mr.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask a quick question of Mr. Walz. Mr. Walz, going back to line 792, you mentioned that a lot of items here were going to another committee, Housing and Health, and I just wanted to confirm it. Does that include the home visiting grants, everything on the top of that page that zeroed out is in that committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes. It's basically a technical thing dealing with the spreadsheet and how it's set up in that we will most likely in conference committee have to move those provisions back into the spreadsheet, and it's easier to leave those lines in than to delete them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
The department may be here at my request. There's two things that I was hoping we could have them talk about, if only in brief. One is the mental health, what that included compared to what the governor proposed, and I don't need a two-hour version, at least just a quick overview on that. And the second was relative to some of the how we're going to meet those work requirements. And I know that the governor had a proposal, and I think the House is doing something different. So just a quick review of those two elements.
Mr. Allen.
Chairman Huntley, members of the committee, I'm Don Allen with the Department of Human Services and the Chemical and Mental Health Administration. To Representative Abler's question, on page 10 of the spreadsheet, at the bottom half of the page is the portion that tracks the governor's mental health initiative. The lines shown in lines 540 through 543 all relate to the expansion of the model benefit set. However, in the House position, it only expands those benefits from from medical assistance to Minnesota Care. It does not expand them into GAMC. It does not do the work necessary to make them all available in PMAP. Further down on line 547, there is a Minnesota Care funding for an intensive outpatient benefit. I will mention that I didn't see the language for that in the bill. But as you mentioned, I haven't had much time to look. And then also at the top of the page, the following page in line 563, there's funding for a rate increase in Minnesota Care, but not in the other health care programs. Again, I didn't see that language in the bill.
Representative Abler.
So you seem like, so there is no rate increase for that provider group? Is that what, do you know that, is that what you're saying?
Representative Abler, I'm not sure. I just got about 2 minutes.
No, I'm not.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the difficulties that folks will have with how we did our spreadsheet versus the governor, a lot of the provider benefit expansions will not be seen under mental health. It's part of some of the other initiatives, and so you have to look at the spreadsheets and some of the other lines. Our mental health stuff is really going to be focused on the grants and expanding with that piece of it. And then as it relates to the integrated care, we left that out, and we'll take that one up in conference committee. But the provider increases are in here.
Okay.
They're just not exactly like the governor, and they're in other sections.
Thank you. And I'm happy for an overview. So he's the bird's eye view is, so keep on if you.
Okay. Well, we can still make some corrections if we agree.
And then the last bit of commonality that I guess I would like to point out is line 602 in the investments adopted from House File 196. Both those bills had investments in crisis services. The governor's bill made them in both adult and children's, and this bill makes them in the adult side. I think that's it as far as a comparison. If there are other questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. Just on that piece of the note, what Mr. Allen just said, there will actually be an amendment either for tomorrow or when we go to Finance Committee that actually shifts some of that money and puts some of that money back into the children's side of the grant.
And Representative Abler.
And if someone is conversant, I see that staff is all busy making amendments everywhere, but if there could just be a short overview on what mental health dollars did get put into the bill, just a 2-minute version of what kinds of things you're buying. Would that be a fair question?
Representative Walker, could you make sure that's done?
Representative Huntley, Representative Abler, I think we can. It's just going to take some time because the biggest piece of it is trying to take out some of the groups from the provider increases. One of the things that we did when we had 297 in front of us before, we just took the different groups that the governor was funding and threw them into, as an amendment, if you remember, into Representative Huntley's bill. And so that groups of expansion is there. It's just staff having enough time to be able to figure out how much money exactly went to each one of those groups. From my understanding, just as an FYI, I believe a minimum, I think it's somewhere around $9 million went to just for some of the COLAs, and then there's another group of money. So I just don't have the exact numbers.
Mr. Chair,
we'll get that for you.
Yeah, and so as it moves toward the floor, perhaps a little discussion of the mental health tactics would be productive for your floor argument anyway. So, thanks.
Representative Walker, you're in charge of that.
Got it.
Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Abrams.
Is another department person or somebody who can talk about how we did our work and some stuff? Is that on the list too of one of the people? Like, the governor had some ways to do some Minnesota paid ways to hit the targets on MFIP and work participation rates and...
Okay, if somebody from the department wants to testify on the MFIP.
And maybe like how you did it. We remember how the governor did it. Maybe just how it's in the bill. That might be straightforward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I'm Ann Sass. I'm from the Department of Human Services. So I'm not sure I understood what you want me to say.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Abler.
Yeah, and, well, the governor had a plan about how to reduce our vulnerability to the not hitting the work participation rates, and there was a, you know, there's some state paid programs and $11 million that magically appeared to be good stuff. And anyway, and it appears the House has a different model that they're providing. And so, could you just describe what it is that we're promoting as a House? What 297 now says would be the method,
Ms. Sessions.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I understand that in the House bill now is there are not strategies designed to improve the work participation rate. The governor had proposed to move some families to non-MOE funding, which takes them out of non-maintenance of effort, which takes them out of the work participation rate, and that's not in the current House bill. And the governor has some other proposals as well that would have helped increase the work participation rate that aren't in the House bill.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. This one is going to be definitely even more so than the mental health or work in progress. And I'm glad I listened to my first mind because I was going to go upstairs to council to work on a couple of amendments and something said stay. And so I'm glad I listened to that first mind. You're right, we did not take a lot of the governor's proposals. I'm actually not a huge fan of a lot of the things that the department was promoting. The Senate has a totally different way of doing some of that stuff. This is something that right before we started that I told the department that we have to meet coming out of hopefully right after the spring break and figuring out a piece of that. There's a difference of philosophy here, and we have to figure out that middle ground. One, do we just push families off just to be in compliance, or do we find a good way to make sure that these families are going to be stable and being productive to take care of their families once they are off? And my philosophy personally is making sure families are stable because they'll end up in part of our other systems if they're not. And so some of the things that were being proposed were just going to be pushing families off. And we're not just talking about families in my district. We're talking about families throughout the state. And especially in some areas where there aren't as many services, I'm really concerned about how we do that. And so it's one of those pieces that we're going to have to talk a little bit more about. And we have plenty of time to do that. But I think this is a step in the right direction in making sure that at least our purpose and our focus in this body will be that we want families to be stable.
Representative Abrams.
Well, that's helpful to understand the philosophy. In terms of what's in the bill, all I know about what's in the bill is from a 20-minute walkthrough yesterday from Mr. Walls talking about some math. And so I'm not trying to be clever. I'm just trying to discover what's in the bill. And so in the bill, he mentioned something about some of the bars were lowered or something just to help. Something is that, do we conform to federal as part of the work in the bill? And were there a couple? Can you tell me what the bill does in that topic, or is it silent on that?
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abel, I'm not quite sure about which piece you were talking about because I was out when Mr. Walls talked about that piece. Are you talking about moving to the exit level piece of it?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, we face some federal sanctions if we don't comply with the rate. And I believe that there is a method that is in the bill that attempts to address that. Can you describe what that method is? Is that a good way to ask it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler. It is not a whole piece. I will be honest about that. We decided to look at it a little differently, and I know some of the language is missing. Pieces of it is going back to Representative Thiessen's bill as it relates to the Family Stabilization Project, and the department even mentioned as it relates to the Senate, they're not comfortable with the process that the Senate has outlined either. And so it's still a work in progress. It's trying to figure out, I think if you, I'm not sure if you were here on Monday when we laid the bill over for possible inclusion, we talked about the fact that the department had gave me a whole lot of paper to look at over the weekend, which I did look at. Didn't understand some of it, but did look at it. And so it's one of those things that making sure that everybody's interest is on the table and is aware. So it's still being worked on. So no, you're not going to find everything that you thought you were going to be looking for.
I'll just take one more back. I'm going to about this. I'll stop. And I respect that it's a work in progress. So was the Thiessen Family Stabilization piece in the bill then?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. There's some language that's important that's not in there that needs to be amended in there. And there's the piece as it relates to, I believe it's a little bit more than $200,000 around some of the sanction pieces that needs to be amended in there.
I look forward to the final piece of our.
Me too.
Any other questions for Ms. Sessions? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Walker, just a little response to...
Thank you, Ms. Sessions.
To some of the comments earlier, you know, you mentioned the governor's bill or proposal did not have anything in the way of helping improve work participation in the MFIP. I thought that's what I heard. My concern really, and as long as we're talking about compromise and working towards some sort of middle ground and philosophies is, you know, this bill really doesn't include that in and of itself. And I think we have to decide philosophically how important it is to increase work participation in the MFIP program. And that hopefully that will be a discussion point that we can work on as we go forward, too.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gottwald. No, you misheard me. What I said was that there was pieces of the governor's bill that, yes, you're right, are in here. And, yes, it would deal with, and you're right, the philosophical pieces isn't about the work requirements. It's about how you do it. Do we stabilize families and then move them off, or do we just move them off knowing that they're not going to be stable? Keep in mind, members, that many of the individual families that we're talking about here could have been off if they could have. We're talking about families that either have children with disabilities, have disabilities themselves, have recently been laid off and are now starting off and trying to get stable themselves, have either some type of other language or some other societal barrier that is keeping them. It's not, we've gotten to the pot, and this is actually why we are having some difficulties in being in compliance with the federal government. We're talking about a group of individuals that are very hard to handle, have many different challenges. Do we just want to be in compliance with the federal government with these families? I'm here to tell you, just taking individuals off to be in compliance, we're going to have some of these families in our child protection system. We're going to have these families that are homeless. And, you know, it's one thing. It's, you know, not that I want them more in the urban area, but imagine if all of your support systems are taken and you're in the rural area, you know, where there's not that many services. And so method is different, yes. Now, I think the goal, hopefully, is the same, that, yes, we have to be in federal compliance, but the other goal that is just as important is making sure that our families are stable. I don't want families just on welfare to be on welfare. I want to make sure that they're stable, that they're not ended up in any of our other systems.
Mr. Chair, I didn't want to engage in a full-fledged debate on this. It was a question about the philosophy, and I did want to ask the department, you know, how important it is to be in compliance. And I, you know, we can get into all that discussion as well. I wasn't arguing with you on that point, but work participation is important, and I would say philosophically it's important to help people get into work. You know, I've always said the best welfare program is a good paying job, but perhaps the department could comment on that.
Yeah. Ms. Sessions, if you could tell us what the magnitude of the penalties would be if we...
Mr. Chair, members, the ancestors, the maximum penalty for failure to meet the work participation rate, if we the maximum penalty that would be there at the beginning would be about, for Minnesota, about $26 million a year. Okay? The department does not anticipate that we would face the entire penalty, and we believe that we, whatever penalty we were assessed, wouldn't be payable for quite some period of time, because we're allowed to negotiate with the federal agency. They will reduce the penalty based on good faith effort. So if the state does things to increase the work participation rate, we are in much better shape in terms of arguing with the federal government about why we wouldn't be subject to the penalty and wouldn't have to pay it.
And Mr. Chair, that's all I wanted to have it for us. Thank you.
Well, why don't we go first? I have on my list is Sue Adderholden from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Sue Adderholden, National Alliance on Mental Illness. I want to start off by thanking you for the total investment in mental health. It's something, as you know, that we've all worked very hard on, even leading up to the session. I know you got mail from us while you were running for office, and we just wanted to make sure that this was a high priority. The thing I'd like to say is that NAMI and other groups, you know, have worked hard both on the governor's initiative and Mindy Greiling's bill, Representative Greiling's bill, and so we feel a little like being asked, okay, which child do you love the most? And I think what we really have to look at during the weeks ahead is which child needs the most. And so we look forward to working with you over the next, you know, couple of weeks to really help figure out which of these items between the Senate and the House bill, which are very different at this point, really need the very most attention. But I do want to say that we really do appreciate the total dollar amount. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association. Figured you might as well do all the mental health at one time. We also applaud the investment in mental health that's in this bill. We're thrilled with the amount that this committee has chosen to invest in mental health. Just to give you a sense going forward, our organization, just like to give you a sense of our three main goals of what we'd like to see as an outcome of this session. One, we'd like to have the benefits expansion, and we'd like to see parity within the public programs. We're very, very pleased that there is an expansion of benefits into Minnesota Care. Hopefully that can include JMC as well. We'd also like to see significant infrastructure investments that shore up the community-based delivery system. And finally, we'd like to see a framework for coordinated care, which means social services such as housing and employment, and also medical services that that manage the patient's mental illnesses and not just respond to crises. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Jessica Webster from Legal Aid.
Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal representation to low-income Minnesotans. And I'm here to just briefly talk about the exchange that just happened a minute ago. As you know, the federal government has presented us a very formidable challenge in terms of meeting the work participation rate. And I really want to thank Representative Walker and the rest of you around the table who have really taken a lot of time to understand the issue of the work participation rate and have looked at how we can meet the work participation rate in a way that is sensitive to really vulnerable families. And what I would just say is that Representative Walker has actually taken the governor's proposal and has just has accepted it, has moved it forward, but has done it in a way that I think will be better for families. And arguably, it also moved a few more families into family stabilization services and off of onto state funds. So arguably, we could be trying to meet the work participation rate a little bit more aggressively. Thank you.
Okay. Next is Trishala Bell.
Hi, my name is Trishala Bell. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee and the Minnesota Welfare Rights Coalition. I'm just going to keep this brief because I know that we have a lot of testifiers. But the Welfare Rights Committee is an organization made up of low-income families, current and former welfare recipients, and we are very glad to see that the Health and Human Service Omnibus Bill makes a start in righting the wrongs done to poor Minnesotans by undoing the cuts of 2003. We are especially applauding the repeal of the SSI penalty and the housing penalty, ending the 20-hour work rule for education, improving extension, and undoing cuts to immigrants. These are all measures that we have been calling for over the past number of years. We are, however, disturbed by the fact that $24 million has been taken out of TANF in what is called refinancing. We are against the refinancing of TANF. Refinancing of TANF means taking federal money and dumping it into the general fund. And once again, we'll say it again, TANF money is not to be used as a cookie jar to fund every project under the sun. Since the TANF block grant began in 1997, poor families have lost over $30 million. And also this year with refinancing, we're losing over $24 million. And that $24 million that's going to refinancing this year can go a long way to improve the situation for poor Minnesotans. It could be used to undo the family cap. It could be used to give a cost of living increase to the welfare grant that hasn't happened in 21 years. Instead, our families will continue to languish at over 72% below the poverty level. In conclusion, we support the Omnibus Bill and the effort it makes to undo many of the cuts of 2003. We say every dime of the $24 million or more that has been taken out of TANF should be given back to TANF so that Minnesotans can undo the remainder of the cuts and give a long overdue cost of living increase to the poorest families. And Representative Walker is right. She took the proposal and she made it even better, and the Senate does too. And that's why we are warning you guys to do the right thing. Poor families have been waiting entirely too long for these cuts to be undone. People are being penalized because they have disabled family members in the household. People are being penalized because they live in subsidized housing. You know, I would hope that you guys would want to make MFIB and any other program in Minnesota that's supposed to be helping poor people move out of poverty a program that helps people move out of poverty, not just get a job and off the roll. So, thank you.
Ms. Bell, it's my understanding there is no TANF refinancing this bill. We did transfer some money out of the TANF that was left, but it went to Ms. Slawick's committee, which deals with early childhood, and I really don't know how she spent it. But Representative Walker, you could...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're both right. is that fair to say? I think really what the organization is trying to make sure that we keep in mind going forward and as things change, and as we know, what we see in front of us will not be the final product coming out of conference committee. And keeping in mind, I think that's what you were trying to stress, to make sure that we don't refinance the money that we have already allocated in this committee. And also in the same voice express their being unhappy with how some of the dollars have been spent in Representative Slawick's committee.
I mean, we're not saying that money shouldn't go towards child care. We applaud that. But however, TANF money should be for TANF families, not TANF eligible. Because if they're TANF eligible, that means that they're eligible to get welfare, but they're not on. So where is that money going to? That's not helping families. It needs to go to the families that are actually on MFIP.
If I may say a couple of things in addition, my name is Deb Knitschny from Welfare Rights Committee. It is TANF refinancing. When TANF money is ever sent to supplant funding that would typically be general fund, we're not saying that the law doesn't allow it. It does allow it, but we would expect much better out of this legislature than to do that again. As Tricia Law already stated, there's been over $300 million taken out of TANF that has supplanted general fund money. What that does is it lets the state off the hook of spending state funds, general funds, on things like child care, housing, that are really, really important. We're not saying that, but it steals from a pot of money for poor families and poor families programs to put into other programs.
And we say that that is unfair. The state has a responsibility to child care. It has a responsibility to housing, but it shouldn't be stolen out of a very minute amount of money that's for the poorest families in this state to make that possible. We say the state should just cough up the money out of the general fund for those important issues and leave the TANF money where it belongs for the poorest families here to undo cuts, all the cuts, to give a cost of living increase and to get the state closer to compliance with federal regulations. And that has not happened. There's been over $24 million that has been taken out of the TANF fund. And our request is that that come back to TANF.
Thank you. Let's see here. Mark Peterson.
Chairman Huntley and members of the committee, my name is Mark Peterson. I serve as president of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Today I'm here to thank you for your service and for your commitment to the well-being of Minnesotans as reflected in this bill. LSS of Minnesota has served Minnesota for 142 years now. We serve 100,000 Minnesotans each year through 2,300 staff and 6,000 volunteers serving people from virtually every county in the state. Our services cover the lifespan. At LSS, we are convicted that Minnesota is at a significant moment in time. There are more and more Minnesotans, a growing critical mass, who believe that assuring that all people have the opportunity to live and work in community with dignity, safety, and hope is a vision that we can achieve. The various commitments to end homelessness in the state are one of those indicators of that. I'm delighted that Catholic Archbishop Harry Flynn and Lutheran Bishop Rognes have a common voice on ending poverty. That's a sign of a change here in this state. Your omnibus proposal here supports this vision of what Minnesota can become by supporting many crucial proposals. I'm especially pleased to see funding for the MRRC waiver for Minnesotans with disabilities included in this bill. The waiver is close to the heart of LSS of Minnesota because we know and support many Minnesotans with disabilities. We take great pride in the fact that Minnesota has replaced life in institutions with community-based services and integration for people with disabilities. In the last few years, however, now more than 5,000 people are waiting for access to care. I assure you that the experience of organizations like ours in the last 3 years has been one of great struggle as we live with the extreme restrictions to access to care that we've experienced. Now, even in Minnesota, 1,000 fewer people are being served today than was true 3 years ago. Funding included in this committee's bill indicates that Minnesota can and will do better for our neighbors and fellow citizens who have disabilities. We're also appreciative to the committee for including COLA funding. Cost of living adjustments for direct support professionals is just a vital part of what we need to strengthen our capacity to serve persons with disabilities. We're also very delighted to see support for senior core services. We believe that senior core services have the opportunity to help us witness dramatic improvement in the care for frail older adults at a cost that will finally reduce overall costs for the state. And finally, we're also delighted to see funding in here again for crisis nurseries. Support for families as they experience extreme vulnerability is very important in prevention of child abuse and neglect. We're delighted to see some money coming back into the crisis nurseries, which have been so important in the last few years. Finally, I just want to say that I'm grateful to you and the hard work of this committee for your tremendous support to the state and to the people of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, and I just would comment that yes, the committee worked hard and will work harder, but it's the staff that really has spent the hours doing the real hard work. We finish up and go home, and they're still here till well after midnight.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark McAfee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee, representing AFSCME, Council 5. I too certainly would begin by thanking the hard work that the members as well as the staff have put into this, begin by saying I think there's a real effort being made to begin to look at the improving the accessibility, affordability, and coverage under health care. And to move towards covering children is a good start. I'd like to thank you for addressing the federal cuts to case management, which we experienced. The Deficit Reduction Act got a good start here with $40 million to the counties and tribes to make up some of the county case management cuts, and also $8 million for child support enforcement grants to the counties. On the mental health initiative, you had heard our concerns. We would say going the route of House File 196 is what we prefer. We realize this will move on to conference committee. We appreciate the COLAs, the nursing homes. We would have liked to see fives, but I guess it points out that we certainly need we need more revenues in the state for health care and all the services we have. Also, as a prior gentleman mentioned, increase in COLAs for some of the waivers, et cetera. And finally, we have state employees that work hard in the various agencies, DHS, health, et cetera. Some of them are present today. And so we would thank you for providing, as a line item, the compensation adjustment. We happen to prefer the Senate position, but that, again, can move to the conference. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. McAfee. Next is Steve Larson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members and staff. On behalf of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities and the ARC of Minnesota, I want to thank you, the chair and members, for your strong support of many of our initiatives. And I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota. I also want to endorse the testimony that we just heard previously on improvements in MFIP, the waiting list, and the mental health initiative, which will help all people, including persons with developmental disabilities. Yesterday, it was a great day when we read about the support that you gave to families who are paying for TEFRA through rental fees. Not only will you help lower the fees for several thousand people that are on the services, are currently receiving TEFRA, but also, as a result, 500 more families, according to the fiscal note, will be able to access medical assistance because of the lowering of those fees. We also appreciate your support for House File 911, self-directed supports. The consortium and the ARC have believed strongly that we need to move towards a long-term care system that is built on self-direction and consumer-driven supports, or our system will collapse under its own weight. By empowering individuals with disabilities and their families to have control over the resources available to them, we will get better outcomes and greater cost-effectiveness in the long run. I know that the committee has labored mightily to give a 3% COLA increase. And as the gentleman before me just cited, they would have liked 5, and I knew that there was some legislation for 6 or 7. The problem is we'll never be able to pay direct care staff under our current system of providing services what they need in order to live off those particular wages. By moving towards a self-directed system, we not only empower individuals with disabilities to control the resources over them, but we are in many instances, and we have examples of our current programs under consumer direction, which we're able to pay staff at a higher rate, a rate that they deserve in order to live on the wages that they're paid. So we would like to commit to work with this committee and with others to continue to move our system, both for persons with the disabilities as well as the elderly, to a system that is self-directed and empowers individuals to attain the outcomes that they desire. In addition, or finally, I want to urge you to support the Quality Assurance Amendment that will be introduced tomorrow by Representative Liebling that will help us start to build a foundation for a statewide quality assurance system to provide oversight to our waivers initially and eventually to all services for persons with disabilities. The Centers for CMS have been critical not only of Minnesota, but of many other states for not providing the level of quality assurance over these programs to provide $1 billion of support to individuals with disabilities. Hopefully, we will get started to lay this foundation, and we'll be able to expand the quality assurance system based on a report that has just been distributed to legislators. Thank you again for your strong support of persons with disabilities in your omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Next, we have Ms. Thurlow. Probably pronounced that wrong. And Patty Cullen.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, we'll do a joint presentation.
That's fine.
I'm Patty Cullen from Care Providers of Minnesota, and myself and Carrie Thurlow will be speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. So thank you for this opportunity to testify. We know that you worked hard to get us the level of funding that you did in the bill for the COLA, but we would not be representing our members very well if we didn't do a but. And I think Representative Abler said it quite nicely a few minutes ago. It was better to be rich and lost than never to be rich at all. So that 5% was nice for the brief period of time that we had it. We do understand that the COLA increase was one of the things that you had as a top priority. But we also need to know, make sure that you remember that 3% doesn't make up for the years of insufficient funding, and it just covers this year's inflationary costs. So again, when you look at one out of every three nursing homes having a negative 5% operating margin or worse, the 3% COLA won't solve the financial stress issues that we have talked to this committee about on more than one occasion in the past weeks. As a reminder, the nursing facilities in this state currently lose $19.98 per resident per day based on the current Medicaid payments, making Minnesota one of the worst states in terms of the gap between ME rates and cost of care. So we were a little disappointed to see that the rebasing proposal was not placed in the bill. We understand that it was a tails issue, but the rebasing language was something that we thought would help this committee and would help legislators go back to their home districts and look in the long term for something that benefits all facilities and that would take into account the gap between the payments and the costs, as well as addressing the rate disparities. In addition, there will be some need for us, without the rebasing language, to circle back with the chair on some language addressing the case mix weights, because those also are not funded in the committee.
Mr. Chair, we also need to point out the fact that we are disappointed that this bill fails to make an investment in capital needs through the moratorium exception process. Currently, there is no funding for the moratorium exception process in this bill. And by way of background, this is the only source of funding for care centers to access to make physical plant improvements in their buildings. We requested $10 million for this fund this year, and they were requested in an effort to ramp up the state's investment to create safer and more desirable living environments for our seniors. Investing in capital needs is every bit as important to the overall quality of care for seniors as is investing in operating rates. As regulations and codes imposed on care centers begin to mount and continue to increase, and as our buildings begin to age, this is a serious issue. As we've told this committee before, over half of the state's care centers will either need significant renovation or replacement in the next 10 years. And the failure to put any money into the moratorium exception process means that the state will fall further behind in capital needs for care centers. This will result in deferred maintenance in our buildings. We will be unable to convert to private rooms in some of our care centers. We will be unable to renovate facilities to make them more comfortable for residents. And so, again, we are disappointed in that point.
There is also in the bill, there was the inclusion of the agency bill relating to assisted living, and we have previously submitted written comments on some of the questions or concerns that we had since there wasn't an opportunity to do testimony. And I think there's a way to kind of fix that out. So we pledge to work, in the next 24 hours, with the chair to an amending language that would make this policy change more acceptable to the Housing with Services members, and I don't think it would take much to do that.
One final point, Mr. Chair, is that we do take note that there is a proposed study that came from the governor's bill on looking at the assisted living or the effect of housing with services on premature impoverishment on Minnesotans. We have expressed our concerns in writing to this committee and would like to continue our discussions with you on tailoring that language to perhaps look at some additional issues that might lead to premature impoverishment for Minnesota seniors. To end on a positive note, we do want to express that we appreciate the time that this committee, as well as the Health Policy Committee, has taken. We know you've spent a significant amount of time looking at the needs of older adult services, and we do appreciate all the time that both committees have looked at. We would like to continue the discussion to talk about how to deliver the resources that this state needs to meet the upcoming age wave that we all know is out there. And we fear that this bill does not get us to where we need to go.
Thank you. And I want to say that the number one thing that disappointed me about this bill, and we did the best that I think we could do, is that we did not do rebasing. I know the Senate has got a start of that, and we'll see how it works out. But that's the number one shortcoming of the bill that we're proposing right now. Deborah Schlick.
Chairman Huntley, committee members, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We're a coalition of 50 organizations throughout the state of Minnesota. Those who do direct service of low-income families, faith-based networks, and advocacy organizations. I'm going to speak briefly to the unfit piece of this bill, and what I'd like to do is clarify some of the conversation and questions that were asked at the beginning of your committee meeting. Because we also believe, and given the questions Representative Abler and Gottwald were asking, believe that hitting the work participation rate is a very important challenge for Minnesota to meet. And so I wanted to explain a couple of pieces of mechanics. We are pleased to see that probably for the first time in many years that that there's a key piece of strategy that the House, the Senate, and the Governor all seem to agree to, which is that we need to change our bookkeeping of how we spend some money so that we're supporting families with the deepest challenges with state funds that aren't on the federal radar screen. And as Representative Walker had explained, the language is inadvertently missing, apparently, in this bill. We've talked with her about language that brings that back in. There is a teeny tiny, tiny fiscal note to that that stands to save the state's millions of dollars. And so there are differences around language with the governor's proposal, but the general strategy is there. What this bill does and what the Senate bill does that the governor did not propose doing was make sure that Minnesota also gets credit for the families who get jobs that take them beyond the current welfare limits. And the House and Senate do that differently, but they both invest some funds in making sure that Minnesota will get credit for the families who get jobs. We think that's important because it helps the state meet the work participation rate, goes further than the administration proposal, but it also helps us move children out of poverty. And that is the other force on the state. In the last 5 years, we've just seen reports out of census data that Minnesota's led the nation in the rate of the number of people going into poverty, 62% increase in this state since 2000. We don't think this is a philosophical tension because we think that this bill does both. It moves children out of poverty and it helps go a long way towards meeting the federal challenge. And then to just reiterate what other testifiers have said today, we are well aware that you've had significant challenges with significant needs in front of you. How do you keep kids safe from abuse? How do you move children and make sure they're not living in poverty? How do you make sure that families working on very low wages can afford child care? How do we make sure that children have health care coverage? And the reason we're in front of you and will continue to be in front of you is because every day parents in the state of Minnesota are trying to make that choice, not for 80,000 children, but for the one or two children who are their children. And they also don't have the resources to meet those very important needs. So thank you for the work you've done on that.
Thank you. Amy Wild.
The next three people are coming with me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I am Amy Wild, a county commissioner from Meeker County, and I'm here representing the county organizations of AMC, LPHA, MICA, and MAXA. I'll provide a few introductory remarks and then turn it over to Paul Fleischner and Mary Wellick for more detail. As you know, counties administer most of the state's human services and many of its public health activities. 40% of county tax dollars go to health and human services. The majority of these state-supervised services are mandated by state and federal law. Thus, changes made at the state level have a direct effect on both county property taxes and on county's ability to assure quality. We have not yet had an opportunity to review the bill language in detail, so my remarks today are more general than I would prefer. From what we've seen so far, the House Omnibus Bill funds many programs, some of which directly or indirectly benefit counties. These include one-time funding for county case management, that's the federal cuts that we experienced, child support, and that program will be matched by federal dollars, so it'll go twice as far, expanding health care coverage for children, health care cost containment, provider rate increases, and mental health investments, all of which we appreciate as county commissioners. However, the bill falls short of providing counties with resources to adequately carry out their responsibilities. In light of, we were cut in 2004 by over $200 million. I will add a couple of specifics and then ask Mr. Fleischner and Ms. Wellick to add more detail. We appreciate the $40 million of one-time and $2 million of ongoing funding for county case management. You may recall our earlier testimony of the need for stable, adequate funding for child safety and protection, services previously funded in part by federal funds. This one-time allocation and the small amount of ongoing funding will help the immediate problem, but it falls far short of our goal for stable, accountable, ongoing funding for a performance-based child protection and safety system. It's great you have funding to cover all kids. Our job, however, and it should be yours as well, is to keep kids from getting to the doctor's office and emergency room in the first place. Every week we read in the paper about a child who was hospitalized with broken bones from child abuse, a child who's left in a car with the windows closed on a hot day, or a baby shaken by a parent frustrated with crying. These very basic services are at risk, or else all other county programs will be jeopardized, and we will significantly raise property taxes to continue these services. Do we want to use property taxes, a regressive and variable funding source, to be the primary source of funding for these core services? The state should play a part in ensuring that children are healthy in ways that go beyond health care. By keeping the most vulnerable of our children safe from abuse and neglect, as in the Slovak Child Safety and Protection Bill, and we thank Representative for that, by helping parents raise healthy children through programs like the Lane Newborn Home Visiting Bill, which is now before Representative Clark's committee, we must reinvest in basic safety net services for which counties bear responsibility and also in F-based prevention initiatives. We would like to see more of this in the House proposal. And thank you, and I will have Mr. Fleischner comment further. He's from Olmsted County.
Good afternoon. I am Paul Fleisner, Director of Community Services for Olmsted County. Thank you for this opportunity, Chairman Huntley, representatives and staff. And thank you for the investments you've made in vulnerable populations. But I'm going to implore you to do more. To me, child safety should be a fundamental expectation in our society. And even the fact that we're fighting over or trying to get dollars for this system amazes me. Now, I am very thankful for the Child Protection and Safety Act and the support of Representative Slawick. I'm concerned about the language being completely put in the bill without ongoing funding, because now we have performance standards and a new unfunded mandate because we asked for $55 million and there's $2 million there. We appreciate the one-time investment, but it's not enough. As I've watched this system over the last several years, since 2003, our county boards have stepped up and bailed out the federal and state government around this service system. I've sat in truth and taxation hearings where our commissioners get the crud beat out of them while they're raising property taxes to protect this system. I implore you to look at new revenue sources to keep this system in place. We've been good stewards of these funds over time. Our outcomes are better. Just to give you an example, in our county, in 2001, after some investments through targeted case management and investments in early intervention, we had at that time we had a recidivism rate in child protection of 14.3%. Last year it was 2.1%. We do not want to risk that over time, and other counties are experiencing similar success. I applaud your investment in crisis nursery. That is one of the best early intervention programs that we have going. In our county, 98% of the kids that end up in crisis nursery never end up with a maltreatment finding in our child protection system. And I also appreciate the support or the funding for child support and urge you to fund our infrastructure kinds of programs like child protection and child support, and even consider those kinds of investments before we move on to new initiatives, because these other programs are core to what we do. The mental health investments are great, but we would urge a consistent benefit set, both in terms of how we administer these programs, which get very complicated, and in terms of consistency and support for our clients. And finally, on MFIP, we support the work to avoid the work participation rate problems and the investments you're making in low-income families. Overall, I think you've done some great work, but I don't think you're done. I would urge you to find new revenue streams for these sensitive and important services, because every kid in our state deserves to be safe. Thank you.
Mary Wellick, welcome back to the committee. How many times have you been here?
Another visit. Thank you, Chair Huntley and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Wellick. I'm the local public health director for Olmsted County. I'm here today representing Local Public Health Association of Minnesota, a voluntary organization representing all 91 county and city health departments in Minnesota. I'm here specifically to speak to the part of the bill that establishes funding for the Minnesota Department of Health's e-health initiative. For the past 3 years, I've had the opportunity to co-chair the statewide e-health advisory committee, along with my colleague Mary Brainerd, the CEO of Health Partners. This advisory committee, made up of public and private partners, is committed to accelerating the adoption and use of health information technology to improve healthcare quality, increase patient safety, reduce healthcare costs, and enable individuals and communities to make the most effective health decisions. The Local Public Health Association is pleased that you've invested $13.5 million in e-health grants for the biennium in this bill. We're pleased that you've expanded the eligible grantees to include local community health boards. Our private partners in the e-health steering committee have made it very clear that healthy communities depend on a viable and electronically linked public health system. Public health departments must partner more effectively with health care providers if we want to reduce threats and barriers to independence and good health. There are many opportunities, from timely electronic health alerts about communicable disease threats to sharing aggregate data about the frequency and number of life-threatening falls by elderly people. Just a couple of examples. We want to continue to work with you in the future to emphasize the importance of the Public Health Information Network, known by the acronym MNFIN. information systems are as basic to good public health systems as fire trucks are to your local health department or to your local fire department. Actually, they're important to us in public health as well. Building this basic information network infrastructure will enable public health departments to communicate electronically with our private health care partners and our partners at the state health department. Through LPHA, right now, local health departments are working on building our knowledge and capacity related to informatics and building our public health information systems. But we really don't have the funding to do that at the local level to create systems that are sustainable. We're disappointed that you're unable to fund the MinFin initiative grant this year, and we're really expecting that we will work with you to secure this important investment in future years. Thank you for the time that you've given us to share with you our priorities.
Thank you, Ms. Wellick. And are there any questions from members? Okay. All right. Well, if there are no questions, thank you to all the testifiers. And we will now hear from Jeff Barsh of Health Partners.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm not Jeff Barsh. I am Carol Backstrom, however, from Health Partners and Regents Hospital. And on behalf of our entire organization, Health Partners, Health Partners Medical Group, and Regents Hospital, we'd like to make a few comments on the bill. First, thank you. Thank you for the targeted investments and benefit expansion for mental health services. We think that this funding is going to go a long way toward improving continuity of care and access for those who need mental health services. Second, we do have, I'm wearing my hospital hat right now, we do have some concerns about the use of hospital-designated DSH funds for other purposes. For the newer members, just a quick background piece. 2 years ago, upon learning that new federal funds were made available for low DSH states, including Minnesota, hospitals came to an agreement, not without, by the way, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, on a distribution formula that would help offset additional rate cuts that imposed by the legislature. Hospitals accepted those additional cuts with the knowledge that the DSH money would help offset those cuts. I'll turn it over to Jeff Barsh now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. A few other comments I'd like to make. I've touched on a couple issues of the bill, working largely off the spreadsheet. We do want to thank the committee for recognizing the importance of critical access dental provider services. I do want to echo some of the comments that were made by Commissioner Wellick around e-health technology. We really do applaud this committee and the legislature's looking at e-health technology and the grants to rural communities to improve access and establishment of health information technology, although we also are very disappointed that that wasn't able to extend to the public health information network. And as we move the healthcare system towards one based on technology, we don't want to leave our public health infrastructure behind. We don't want half the world working on computers and public health working with post-it notes. That doesn't make a lot of sense for coordinating that type of communication. I'd also like to point out quickly some language in the bill in Section 7, Article 7, both Sections 2 and Sections 51. This is bringing into this bill an issue around lawsuits associated with insurance, particularly direct liability and bad faith. This is new to this committee.
Excuse me, Mr. Brecher, can you give us a page reference?
I'm sorry, I'll try to look really quickly. Article 7, Sections 2 and then Section 51. Section 51 is on page 206, and Section 2 is on page 163. And this is both direct liability and then good faith insurance practices. The reason this issue hasn't been heard by either the Health Policy or the Health Finance Committee is the intent of this legislation was never to apply to health insurance, and this has been stated by the author of the bill and other committees. And as this language has actually moved through other committees, there has been a direct exemption for a health insurance license in this state. That exemption is not listed in the language today. So we're hopeful that as this bill moves forward, we can clarify that. Without that clarification, we have some very serious concerns that this would have a dramatic impact on health insurance premiums in the state.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Thiessen.
Are Sections 49 and 50 also related to that same?
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, just quickly to continue and wrap up, I would like to also talk about the $6 million appropriation for the Health Insurance Exchange. The language of this is moving in House File 1873, Representative Bunn's bill. I think there are a lot of people who look at the concept of the exchange, particularly its ability to allow small employers a different option for offering coverage, is something that we do seriously want to consider. I think it's actually very creative to create that option. There's some questions about the legality of small employers, in particular offering Section 125 plans and then thereby qualifying them as an ERISA plan. I'm not going to get into that because I'm not an attorney. I want to raise one concern we have with spending the $6 million to set up the exchange. And that is, as we set up the exchange, we at the same time require and or mandate that all individual insurance policies in the state have to be offered through the health insurance exchange. And that means for your constituents, whether they be farmers or self-employed people who are currently purchasing individual insurance in the state, they now have to go through a separate administrative or bureaucratic step to get that insurance. And, of course, along the way, they're going to pay a fee for that. Now, as the exchange is written and has been talked about, they do anticipate a small fee to make this ongoing. And we understand that. If this thing is adding value to the system and people want to pay the fee to use it, that makes sense. But you're requiring people to go through the exchange before that value is established, and you also have no control over what those fees might grow to be. Originally, the proposal from the governor had asked for $12 million. If we're only funding it at six, what are those fees expected to be? Are they supposed to be doubled from the original proposal, tripled, quadrupled? We don't know. In the future, should the exchange not be able to self-sustain, how will the fees on the products sold through the exchange grow? We don't know. And as long as it's a mandatory system, there is no check on the exchange through the private market to keep those fees down. And that is a very, very serious concern to ours, that you are disrupting the individual marketplace to set up this new system. And so we just wonder, as we go forward and we're investing the money through the state, $6 million is a lot of money, that we seriously consider whether or not we want to commit the individual marketplace, which is functioning quite well in the state, to that system when we don't know how it works. That's all the comments we have at this time. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Representative Bunn has a question.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair, and Council Fires. I just want to comment on the last comment from Mr. Birch regarding the exchange. I think that there are a number of issues that continue to be need discussion regarding the exchange. It's a very new concept, and I think both from the House and from the Governor's office that this was from the Governor's proposal that we will need to, you know, continue discussion about some of those things as we go forward in the next months. And also I expect that the Healthcare Transformation Task Force I would expect it also to take a look at some of those issues that continue to be raised.
Thank you. Any other members? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Barsh, in the Senate bill, there's a reduction in or a mandate, a separate Senate bill, let me put it that way, that mandates a reduction in the growth in premiums. If we do that, how is that going to affect the health plan versus the providers?
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, the Senate language that passed off the Senate floor after a second vote just a couple days ago puts a limitation on health insurance premium increases and also health expenditures in the state. While it might have been stated for some that the intent is to level the bargaining field between health plans and providers, I certainly don't know that that's going to be the case, and I don't believe that that's going to be the case. I think what the effect of that legislation is going to do is to decrease the amount of revenue we can collect in premiums. That won't necessarily decrease what we pay out to providers or what our patients and our members need as far as services. So what you have at the end of the day is health plans who are unable to collect money to meet their expenditures, which puts all of us at risk for survival. And that's our concern with that proposal.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? No questions? Okay, thank you very much, testifiers. And next on the list, we have Mary Reagan from the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. Welcome, and please give us your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Reagan, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies and the CTSS Coalition. Our members provide over 120 programs around the state, working with emotionally disturbed and seriously emotionally disturbed children and their families. As others have indicated, we are as well grateful for your attention to mental health, your allocation for mental health, and we're happy to hear from Representative Walker that there is some money for rate increases for providers. We look forward to seeing that. But I wanted to take this opportunity to make sure you're aware of the urgency and need for significant rate increases for CTSS providers. CTSS is Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. These are services that are provided in the community, in families' homes, in the schools, that allow children to remain in their schools, remain at home. These providers offer skill-building services, therapy, day treatment across the state of Minnesota. They have never had a cost of living increase. One of the rates was increased in 2004, but we're really looking at a structural deficit with how these providers are paid and how they're operating. Most of them are literally on the verge of closing. I heard from one this morning who was told yesterday that unless a significant rate increase occurs, that they will have to close their program. Their board is no longer willing to subsidize them at a cost of $75,000 a year. I have another member who's operating with a $150,000 deficit. Another that loses 74 cents a mile every time they send somebody out to do therapy or skilled services in the community. These folks are extremely vulnerable and work very well with an awful lot of children around the state. The governor's bill, there was some recognition of this. In the governor's proposal, there was a 23.7% increase for some of these services. In Representative Breiling's bill, there was a 33.7% increase for these services. So unfortunately, we're not talking about a small amount of money. And I recognize that you have priorities, you have things you need to look at, but I'm just hoping to impress upon you how important this is and how much a difference it will make if we don't have these providers. I represent the full continuum of care. My members, in addition to providing in-home services, also provide secure residential treatment. Both the CTSS providers and the residential treatment centers have waiting lists. The CTSS folks can't afford to serve any more kids, and the residential treatment centers are building beds so that they can. I don't think this is the way we want to continue in Minnesota, so I really hope that there's some way to look at the appropriations, the decisions we've made, and make some adjustments. And thank you again for all your work.
Okay, thank you. Members, are there any questions? Okay, I see no questions, so thank you very much. And we will go on to Jim Hattican from Gillette Children's Hospital. Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is James Hattican. I am the Chief Financial Officer at Gillette Children's Specialty Health Care. I have had the privilege of testifying before this committee recently regarding under-reimbursement of Medicaid outpatient payments at Gillette, and I want to thank you for your efforts to assist us in that regard. I'm here today for a different reason, to speak to the change in disproportionate share payments and what effect that could have on Gillette. Currently, even with DSH payments, Gillette pays, or Medicaid pays, only 88% of the cost of delivering care, with annual losses to Gillette of over $1.8 million. The loss of DSH funding would reduce our reimbursement by an additional $3 million, creating annual losses of over $4.8 million. With losses of that magnitude, there will be dip cuts in staff and programs at Gillette. We wouldn't have any choice if the loss of those kind of resources will affect not only the Medicaid patients, but all of the patients that Gillette sees. And we do see patients from every county in the state of Minnesota. In conclusion, let me just say that these changes in dish payments would be very detrimental to Gillette and to children with disabilities in Minnesota, very detrimental to their families, and I urge you to consider this in your deliberations. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for members? Oh, okay, Representative Abler.
Two things, Madam Chair. Maybe later someone can tell us about how the dish thing works in this bill this week and get the overview on that. But I have a question for the witness. In the bill also is the House File 1 cover all kids thing. And if that were to pass, would that make any difference to you all? Are you familiar with that proposal?
I'm not sure I am.
Okay, well, it's basically a way to bring everybody into, if they need the care, there'd be no uncovered kids. They'd be paid out at medical assistance rates or plus about 3-5%. How would that make a difference in your world?
Many of our patients already are covered by Medicaid because we deal primarily with disabled children. Having more patients that are covered by Medicaid would, in general, be detrimental because the Medicaid rates already are paid below cost.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, I mentioned that earlier that one of the big faults of the bill we have is lack of rebasing for nursing homes, and I think the second major problem is some of these cuts to hospitals. Now, they're still getting a big boost over what they got in the last biennium of about $92 million, but there are some serious problems with how we're going to deal with this particular problem. And Mr. Hadigan, all I can say is, quote Yogi Berra, it's not over till it's over. And it's not over yet.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And you see, Mr. Walz isn't here, or we could maybe get an explanation from him about what's going on with these.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the dish proposal is actually Governor Plenty's proposal.
Madam Chair, members, the hospitals were to get for the next biennium, and it was part of an agreement they had when they got a big ratable cut in the last budget session. That starting in July of 07 and then through that two-year period, they would get about $24 million extra payments. And the governor, when he looked at this, well, I don't know what the governor did, but I assume he looked at the size of that $92 million rebasing and decided that it's tough to put another $24 million on top of that. And we have used his position.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Representative Chair. Huntley. Representative Abel.
I hope members and representatives now just don't mistake my questions for even a criticism. I'm just trying to get my arms around the bill. I'm on page, I'm on page 65 looking at the text for the first time, and I'm trying to assist in the man so I can know what you're proposing. So,
well, Representative Abler, I've heard you express that concern a few times today, and from my looking around, I don't think anybody's taking it that way. So go ahead and ask your questions. That's what we're here for. Okay. Next on the list, we have Erin Sexton from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Is she here?
She doesn't want to go.
Oh, I'm sorry. Apparently her name has been taken off. Okay. Mary Krinke from the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I have with me today Paul Cassidy, who is representing Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's been a lot of discussion already today, and something tells me over the course of the next month or so, we might be talking about disproportionate share hospital payments for some time. Let me just state for the record that the Minnesota Hospital Association supports many of the provisions that are contained in this bill, and I regret that I have to focus my comments today on an aspect of the bill that we don't support, and that is the taking of the hospital dish money. As has been alluded to, the 2005 session was a very difficult legislative session. For those of you who were serving in the legislature here, I know you felt like you were here all summer long, as did many of the lobbyists as well. And what happened that session, the Health and Human Services Committee was faced with a very big budget target and significant cuts that they had to make. And a 6% cut was made in hospital inpatient payment rates. And as part of the agreement with the legislators, it was Senator Berglund and primarily Representative Fran Bradley as the two chairs of the committees, they knew that there was additional federal disproportionate share hospital money that was available from the federal government. And so as part of our negotiations that year, we took additional cuts at the hospitals, and knowing that we were going to get some of those cuts offset by future DSH money. And let me just say, I know that the Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services believes that this money can be used for other purposes. However, we at the Hospital Association believe that disproportionate share hospital payments, and that's what the federal government calls this money, disproportionate share hospital payments, we believe that that money needs to be used for hospital payments. So while the legislature was negotiating all the Health and Human Services bill, Senator Berglund and Representative Bradley instructed us at the Hospital Association to go back amongst our members, and this was like a UN agreement. I know Ms. Backstrom referred to it as blood, sweat, and tears. But they asked us to come up with a funding formula for DSH that all of our members could agree to. And this was very strenuous discussions at the Hospital Association. And we came up with a formula, and it is in current law now, and there are three buckets of hospital payments. There's one category at 13%, one category at 10%, and one category at 4%. And it was based on how much Medicaid patients you had. And if you had a higher percentage of Medicaid patients, like the children's hospitals do, you were in our 13% bucket. If you were a large outstate hospital, and I don't mean to pick on Representative Huntley here, but the two hospitals in Duluth, they were in the 10% bucket. And if you were a hospital that did not have as much Medicaid business, you were in the 4% bucket because your hospital did not have as much hurt or as much burden with the cuts that went through because you didn't have as much Medicaid business. So we came to an agreement at the Hospital Association. We came back over to the Capitol and we presented this to Senator Berglund and Representative Bradley, and they agreed to the 6% inpatient rate cut, knowing that the hospitals were going to get this disproportionate share hospital money at the federal level. So with that on the record, I just would like to say that we hope to work with this committee and members of the Senate as this bill goes to conference committee, and we are hopeful that we can get the DSH money restored to hospitals. So with that, there are many other good things in this bill, and we look forward to working with you over the next month. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. I have a question first before I go to Representative Abler. And Ms. Krinke, maybe you'd be the one that could answer this for me. As you know, CMS is also changing the distribution of MRC funding and changing it in such a way that it I'm sure you know this very well, and it's going to follow, as I understand it, the distribution of medical assistance patients more so than the where the training is happening. And how is that then intersecting with this DSH payment issue, since we're all talking about how much medical assistance hospitals are providing?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, another issue that is probably going to be dealt with over the course of the next month are different approaches to the distribution of MRC dollars. As of now, the Hospital Association is neutral because we have members on both sides of this issue as to how the MRC money should be divided. Let me just say there's no right or wrong here. It's a balance between should the money follow the number of Medicaid patients, but there's also a desire to educate our future physicians. Should it be based on the number of students or residents that you have? So this is a tricky issue. Obviously, we want to be in federal compliance and get as much federal dollars into Minnesota as we can. So,
Okay, but let me just follow up for a moment, and I understand your association's position. I'm not asking you to take a position here. I'm just kind of noticing that with the change in how the MRT money is distributed, that's going to go more under the new federal requirement. That is going to go more to hospitals that have more Medicaid patients. And when we're talking about the DSH payments, we're talking about the loss of payments that would be going in the same manner, presumably, or under this formula you've described. They follow more to the hospitals that have this higher proportion of Medicaid patients. Am I right? So it seems like there might be some fill-in for the hospitals that might be losing a lot of the DSH money here from the new formula, or am I missing something?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not familiar with any connection between our DSH money and the MRC money. But there might be somebody else who knows more about the issue than I do.
Well, I don't know that there's any formal connection. I'm just saying that since they're both responding to the same issue, I'm just wondering what the perhaps unintended intersection might be. But anyway, I'll go on to Representative Abler's question, and then if somebody else in the audience wants to address that, we could do that.
Thanks. And I guess I'll jump back to the other question for Ms. Krinke when she's through consulting there. You can talk. The governor, you know, from my chair, the proposals just fly around here. We've heard, I don't know, 100 bills and lots of bills on all topics, all kinds of fixes. And then finally they come into a bill, and this has got some legs, and then the Senate's got some legs, and the governor proposed, and the legislature disposes. But in the governor's bill, the $24 million was there also. Did you talk to the governor, and did he have a good idea about why that should be that way? It seems like the House is liking the governor's way of doing that, and did he defend why that was a good idea?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would feel more comfortable having DHS answer that question than having me answer that question.
Well, maybe that's different, the one you can answer. Did your group go approach him and say, what are you doing? Or did you just kind of wait and see what happens?
Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they have known, the Department of Human Services has known that the Hospital Association has been very protective and very concerned about DSH payments, and we've been tracking what's been going on at the federal level with changes at CMS, and so we were very surprised by the agency's proposal.
Madam Chair, maybe when we get through with this, the department can tell us why it's a good idea.
Okay. Other questions for members? Is there anybody from the department that wants to come down and answer Representative Abler's question? Okay. So I'm not seeing anybody.
Man, there's no one from the department that can answer that question today. We're going to the door. They just don't want to come down. Oh, there I am. All right. Well, maybe who's ever here from the department can remind them that we're serious about the answer to this question. I think we're all eager to hear the answer. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you then. If there are no other questions for members for these testifiers.
Mr. Cassidy.
Oh, Mr. Cassidy. Yes. Sorry. Did you have something you wanted to add here?
Please. Chair. Paul Cassidy, I represent Children's Hospitals and Clinics. I represent one of the hospitals that's in the big bucket that Ms. Krinke referred to. If you recall testimony that I provided this committee last week on House File 1404, it said that Children's expected loss for 07 on Medicaid reimbursement was $20 million in 07, and this was after factoring in the rebasing that I think you keep referring to in terms of this new money that's coming into the system. With the elimination of the DSH payments that are proposed in this bill, Children's will take approximately another $4 million hit in the next biennium and upwards of $15 million over the next two bienniums, which represents almost 15% of all those DSH dollars being borne by one institution, that being Children's Hospitals and Clinics. As you can see, these cuts just keep adding up going back to 2002. Madam Chair, a couple of other things I'd like to cover are a couple of myths that I think follow these issues. Number one is that rebasing was a big windfall for us and for some other hospitals and made us whole. When the fact is that rebasing really just brought us up to 2002 cost levels, leaving a 5-year gap between 2002 and 2007. And if you add all these up, between the 4.5% annual health care inflation rate and 11.5% in budget cuts going back to the 2002, 2003, and 2005 MA cuts, leaves us 29.5% short, using crude math at this point. Number two is that if we cover more kids, you have more patients and you have more money. That's Representative Abler's point. That's false. You can't volume your way out of this this problem. No hospital can. More patients means more losses. This is one of the main objectives of the DSH payments, to attempt to help make hospitals whole who serve populations, cover their costs, or mitigate our losses. Cover All Kids is a wonderful proposal. We support it wholeheartedly. But Cover All Kids without a payment fix is just simply unsustainable. Finally, Madam Chair, the proposal alone will raise our expected losses on Medicaid services to well over $20 million for each of the 2008-2009 budget years. With that, we support many of the investments that you're trying to make in this proposal, but the DSH provisions we oppose adamantly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Madam Chair.
Stand for questions.
Thank you.
$20 million, you said? And the cut overall is, I think, maybe $50 million with you, when you include the federal match. So how do you get to $20 million? That's, I thought you said 15%.
Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, the $20 million I was referring to, currently we're almost at $20 million in losses for our Medicaid, covering our Medicaid costs. This will take it over that, so I'm actually probably underestimating what our total losses are going to be once you take away even more DSH dollars.
Okay, Representative Huntley had a question.
Either one of the testifiers, the cut in 2005, the I think it was 5% rateable reduction, what was the net of that to hospitals?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, the cuts to hospitals and for the last biennium were over $200 million. The DSH money for this biennium, according to the spreadsheet, is $22.8 million for this biennium and $68 million for the next biennium. So if you look at $22 million and $68 million together, and the total cuts from the last biennium were $200 million and scheduled to be for the 08-09 biennium, $234
million. Well, follow-up, Madam Chair, the DSH, the $24 million was initially intended to be for one biennium, not continue into the future.
Thank you. Our testifiers look puzzled. Do you want to comment, Ms. Krinke? No? Okay. Other questions? Members, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, could you explain that again? I've been trying to figure all this out, and now you threw me a little bit here.
Representative Humbley.
My understanding of the agreement in 2005 was that the hospitals would get this $24 million the upcoming biennium, but that was a one biennium deal and then would not continue into the base.
Thank you. Other questions, members?
Madam Chair.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Cassidy.
Madam Chairman, I want to go back to a question that you had earlier about the MRF money and answer your question as it relates to children. Number one, it is one proposal that obviously is in the mix right now, both on the United side and in the House. For children's, I think in the best case scenario, under either proposal, they will net, I believe, $2.4 million, but which will somewhat mitigate what we project to be a fairly large cut in the DSH payments if this goes forward.
Okay, Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, because the rate cuts go on forever unless the legislature takes action, we believed that the DSH payments were going to go on forever as well. Now, I'm not trying to disagree with Representative Huntley. That's just not the way we believe the agreement was structured in 2005. So if the rate cuts go on forever, we think the DSH offset should go on forever, too. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Krinke. Well, that kind of illuminates where we have a point of disagreement here anyway, I guess.
Representative Huntley, did you want to say something more?
I'm actually not going to talk about that, but the if a hospital has 30% of its payments coming from medical assistance and Medicare, they can cost shift those on to the rest of the their patients. But Mr. Cassidy is correct that the children's hospitals have a huge percentage of people on medical assistance, and hardly anybody left to shift those costs on to.
Okay, thank you, Representative Huntley. Other questions for members? Okay, thank you, testifiers. Appreciate it. And we have on the list Will Wilson. He already testified, okay. And Chris, looks like Flatten would like to speak to us. Welcome to the committee, and please give us your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Flatten. I'm a member of the MHAG Steering Committee, the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, and also the past chair of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. I appreciate the work that you've done on this bill. I also am going to be very blunt and say that I'm very disappointed in the ways that you've chosen to fund mental health in this bill. I'm not disappointed that you're funding mental health, but I am disappointed in the ways that you're doing it. We really need reforms in the mental health system, not just money. Through the MHAG process, we have, in a bipartisan and with a multiple stakeholder group, worked very hard over the last 3 years to develop and come up with an effective and efficient design for reform for the mental health system. Reform is always hard because it means change, and everybody gets nervous about changes. But nevertheless, we continue to meet. We argued, we discussed, we negotiated, we compromised. Intentionally, we did not micromanage all the details. It was clear that different parts of the state would develop different kinds of proposals based on the needs and priorities in their particular areas. But through the MHAG process, we stayed in connection and consulted with the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, which is the group which is designated to advise the governor and the legislature on mental health issues. This 30-member bipartisan body unanimously fully supports the governor's mental health initiative, including the preferred integrated care networks and their opportunities to coordinate care. At a conference of 150 mental health consumers, I heard over and over again astoundingly clearly how much people want their mental health services and conditions to be treated as medical conditions, which they are. People are really tired of being shuttled into the mental health social services bucket instead of getting their care as a medical condition. The preferred integrated care networks are an opportunity to do that. The infrastructure grants, which provided for more coordination of care and for specific services that, again, we've worked very hard on developing over the last 3 years, were an opportunity to do that. So, again, I'm very disappointed that you've not supported these mental health reforms. And I, frankly, don't know how I'm going to explain this to the mental health consumers that I represent. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Brock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if staff or Representative Huntley or Ms. Flatten can help me out. I'm trying to recall what dollars were associated with that network in the bill. Do you have any recollection of that?
Representative Huntley.
Or where on the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I don't recall the number of dollars for that particular part of it. Mr. Walls is upstairs working right now, so he would be the one that can answer, but I don't...
you can have something from the department, maybe?
Mm-hmm. I think Mr. Allen is on his way down.
Mr. Allen, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Don Allen again.
In the governor's proposal, this is a little bit of a difficult answer, question to answer, Representative Broad, because it assumed the adoption of the model benefit set across all the health care programs as the basis for that. So there are costs associated with doing that first. Beyond that step, with the financing proposal that the governor had around transferring grants and the amount of the responsibility that was transferring back and forth to the plan, the cost was very minimal for that portion of the proposal. It amounted to including administrative costs, it was $103,000 the first year, $424,000 the second, $361,000 the in FY10, and $569,000 in 2011. So less than half a million.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much. See, next. We have Deb Holmgren.
Patricia Siebert was going
to. Okay, well, she's not on the list. If you can make it really brief, we'll. Okay, please introduce yourself.
My name is Patricia Siebert. I'm representing the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I was on the MHAG steering committee with Ms. Slotin and many others, and have worked with the departments, the counties, and so on the implementation process for the governor's initiative. I just want to briefly speak to the preferred integrated networks, which were eliminated from the bill. I think some of you, but perhaps not all of you, have heard my testimony and that of others, that people who have mental illnesses have an average lifespan that is 25 years less than the rest of us. One of the reasons that I supported this integrated network was with the hope that some of the health problems, not just mental health problems, of people with mental illnesses would be addressed through this process of integrating physical and mental health care. I think it's an important innovation and an important aspect of reforming a mental health system that now is not present in the bill. The county social services system is not going to be able to address that sort of integration that we need in the way that an integrated network would be. And I think you've just heard testimony from Mr. Allen. The cost is not that steep, particularly with some of the transfers, for example, to Minnesota Care and the added benefit set in medical assistance. So I would urge you to keep the whole concept of integration of physical and mental health care and the notion of trying out these integrated networks in front of you in this bill and also in the future, because it's an idea whose time has come and I think it needs to be tried. And just briefly, I also wanted to mention that funding the model benefit set in general assistance medical care is really an important idea because it's a preventive measure that keeps people from getting to the point where they become fully disabled and then, ta-da, qualify for medical assistance in the services. So those are two important things I just wanted to put before you for your future deliberations.
Thank you. All right, Deb Holmgren. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Holmgren. I'm president of Portico HealthNet. I'd like to first thank Representative Huntley and all the members of this committee for all of your hard work to increase access to health care for people who are falling through the cracks in the coverage system in Minnesota. I'm here to speak in support of the expanding access to public health care programs and also to underscore the importance of providing outreach support services so that eligible individuals become successfully enrolled in public programs. Just so you know our experience, since 1995, Portico assisted over 11,000 people onto public health care programs or onto Portico's access program. We've been successful because we work in partnership with school districts, churches,
healthcare providers, counties, and many other community-based organizations. Last year, through our efforts, our outreach efforts in Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington counties, Portico helped over 700 metro area residents successfully enroll in Minnesota Care, medical assistance, or general assistance medical care. These people represent our success stories. Because of current eligibility limitations, however, only about 20% of the 11,000 people Portico talked to in 2006 even appeared to be eligible for a government health care program. Every week, Portico communicates with an average of 50 new families who are not currently eligible for anything in terms of health care insurance programs. For every 10 people we screened for eligibility in 2006, only one eventually became enrolled in a government program. We are happy that this community problem is addressed in House File 297 by expanding eligibility for public programs. Another major concern is that it's difficult to get people enrolled in government programs even when they appear to be eligible. We employ 9 people at Portico whose jobs are to identify people in the community without insurance who might be eligible for a government program and then help them work through the process of applying. Last year, we initiated the application process for 2,100 individuals. Only 748 of those individuals were eventually approved for medical assistance, GAMC, or Minnesota Care. This represents a 35% success rate. It means that for every one person that we helped that got on, 2 didn't. I'm not sharing this information because I want you to think we're not good at our jobs. I'm saying that even with experienced, knowledgeable, bilingual staff to guide and advocate for people throughout the enrollment process, still 2 out of 3 people who appear to be eligible don't make it. Sometimes it's a matter of being on the borderline for eligibility and income or assets, which may have been just a little too high. More often, the problem is related to a process that seems to discourage enrollment rather than facilitate it. It's not unusual, for example, for a family that applied for medical assistance last November to not become enrolled in the program until late April, about 6 months later, due to the large and complicated amount of validation that has to be submitted and to the county's backload of applications. When application review is delayed, families are sometimes asked to provide duplicate supporting documentation or asked to go back several months, for example, to come up with the required paycheck stub from an employer for whom they may no longer work. So eventually, many applicants just give up. Portico supports House File 297 because it addresses the first problem that too many children and families in Minnesota are not eligible for health care coverage and consequently are not accessing needed services. We support the bill's language to provide competent, experienced advocates to assist families and children throughout the state to successfully become enrolled in public health care programs. As the health bills move through the process, we urge you to include in the final product language and funding for outreach services, not just for the Children's Health Security Act, but for all public programs. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for members? All right. Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And we will go to Bruce Nelson. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM, and we're an association of providers that support people with disabilities. And I will be very brief, although I'm going to go back 20 years when I had a job similar to Ms. Holcomb's. And over the course of the 5 years from 1987 to 1992, we developed, and I was honored to be part of the process that developed Minnesota Care. And one of the proudest moments of my life was to be able to work with good people on that. And was grieved to see some of the cuts that occurred in the last few years. And so it is with great excitement that I'm very thrilled to see that we're back on the road to restoring Minnesota Care and moving toward the ultimate goal of health care that's accessible and affordable for all Minnesotans. So I'm very thrilled about that aspect of the bill. And it really does have a correlation with the people at ARM. And we thank you for the COLA in the bill that will help out about 27,000 direct support professionals in our industry. Many of those folks, unfortunately, do not have health care. So we look to the movement in this bill and all the work ahead of helping out those folks and would like to be able to work with you in the healthcare transformation task force as you move ahead. I think we have a lot to offer, and it will help many fine people who ironically provide the care and support to our most vulnerable citizens but don't have access to healthcare themselves. I want to thank you for the COLA. I'm doing some rough math. It figured out about 32 cents per direct support professional. And while that doesn't truly acknowledge, and I know you know that, the value of their work in supporting our most vulnerable citizens, I do know that they will be very appreciative when this bill finally becomes law and they're being acknowledged for the work that they do. And very briefly, there's a number of other things in the bill that we're grateful for. The parental fees that Mr. Larson spoke about, the new waiver slots that Mr. Peterson and Mr. Larson talked about, dental access, critical dental access, the self-directed supports for people with who are supported by PCAs takes us a great step towards consumer-directed services, and we're able to do that cost-effectively. The disability linkage line, assistive technology, there are many things in this bill that I applaud you for and thank you. there are a couple of things I would like to bring up very briefly. Excuse me. I do want to thank you for not including something, and that was the expansion of the 245B standards that the governor recommended to the CADI-CAC TBI waivers. There was a proposal, however, that as an alternative that was didn't cost nearly as much, and I think may help the state make sure it's able to address concerns raised by CMS to be able to continue funding for those waivers. And it's very important to the state that we maintain those waivers. There is a provision that's similar to what was in Representative Rukavina's bill that's not in this bill. It is in the Senate bill, and I ask you when you go into conference committee that you look at that. And finally, there was a provision that might come up in an amendment tomorrow or in finance committee that makes sure that the money is there for people who've been getting PCA services, living in foster care, who, because of a rider last year, were able to move over to the CADI waiver. The money didn't move with them. And the bill authored by Representative Huntley, and that might come up as an amendment, would make sure that money's there. It is in the Senate bill. They're counting it as budget neutral. I know that you'll have to look at that and see if indeed it is, but at some point in time, I hope you can address that issue. It really affects services dramatically for people with mental illness. So with that, Madam Chair, I thank you, and I guess I did talk a little longer than I thought I would, but thanks for the bill and the hard work.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. I think we have a question here. Representative Abler.
Just the math figuring. You know, the COLA is almost a little more than $250 million, and I just did. It's kind of, even at 33 cents, and oh, man. So I just did a little math. It's about every million buys about a penny and a quarter an hour for the work. Mm-hmm. So it's money well spent, but it's amazing how it adds up. And I just, thanks for making it kind of real to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Okay, any other questions or comments from members? All right. Thank you very much, and we'll move on to Carol Spector. Welcome to the committee, and please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carol Spector, and I'm the Advocacy and Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
I will be very brief. It's been a long line of testimony, and I was just in front of this committee earlier this week talking about the importance of covering all children. So I just wanted to thank the committee for putting the Children's Health Security Program into the omnibus bill. This provision in the bill will create a clear path for coverage, not just coverage, but affordable and accessible and quality coverage for all Minnesota children. It'll be creating a barrier-free program will significantly increase access, and I think that's a wise investment for our state, and so I just want to thank the committee for their commitment to an investment in children's health. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Well, are there questions for members or comments? Okay, that is the end of our list of folks who've indicated that they would like to testify on this bill. Is there any other business for the committee today? All right, then, we are adjourned.